TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Cuba, the Spanish-American War, and the Rise of U.S. Imperialism by Michael Parenti. As President Obama becomes the first sitting U.S. president in almost 90 years to visit Cuba, he took the same stage where Calvin Coolidge in 1928 lectured the Cubans on democracy. The U.S. then controlled Cuban national and foreign politics and the Cuban economy, and had done so since the end of the Spanish-American War in 1898. The U.S. had refused to end the military occupation unless Cuba changed its constitution and ceded its sovereignty to the U.S. The infamous Platt Amendment of 1901 gave the U.S. the right to intervene unilaterally in Cuban affairs and included a clause that eventually led to the perpetual lease of Guantanamo Bay. All this was in force when Coolidge took the stage in 1928. Nevertheless, he said about the United States, quote, "Our most sacred trust has been and is the establishment and expansion of the spirit of democracy." Now in 2016, I can't think of a better program to revisit than the extraordinary lecture by Dr. Michael Parenti on the Spanish-American War. U.S. media and politicians are still lecturing Cuba on democracy, and very few commentators are looking back at the history among the two countries. Meanwhile, President Raúl Castro asked Obama during his visit for the return of Guantanamo Bay. Here's my introduction to the original broadcast in 2005. Michael Parenti is among our leading progressive political analysts. He received his PhD in political science from Yale in 1962 and has taught at colleges in the U.S. and abroad. Michael Parenti uses the history of the Spanish-American War to answer several very intriguing questions. Who first expressed the desire to annex the island of Cuba, and when? Why did the U.S. attack the Philippines when it was Cuba that they wanted to take over? Why did the U.S. give verbal support to the liberation movement against Spain while selling weapons to Spain to fight the Cuban popular movement? The early African-American emancipation movement inside the U.S. was critical of U.S. plans to attack Cuba. Why, their leaders asked, was the U.S. government concerned about the Spanish repression of the rights of Cubans, while the repression of African-Americans within the U.S. was ignored? Some said, quote, "The Negro needs freedom just as much as the Cubans." The Spanish-American War was an important turning point in the transition of the U.S. to an imperial power, and many of the forces at work are eerily contemporary. Here is Michael Parenti with answers to these questions in part two of the lecture series on history, The Spanish-American War and the Rise of U.S. Imperialism.
The Spanish-American War was fought between the U.S. and Spain in 1898. Now, well before that war, American business interests had been growing overseas and enjoying the protection of the U.S. Navy and Marines. But the war does mark a turning point in that process, that is, a turning point in the use of American military power to ensure economic expansion. In 1898, Cuba was still a Spanish colony. And by the way, there already was a war underway. It had been going on for years. It was a war between the Cuban insurgents, the Cuban National Liberation Forces, against the Spanish colonial army. Well, why did the U.S. intervene in Cuba by sending the battleship Maine down there and doing a bunch of other things? Supposedly, the Maine's visit was just a friendly visit, and supposedly McKinley was concerned about protecting American interests in Cuba. But what were American interests in Cuba? Supposedly, Washington was at odds with Madrid because Spain was acting in a repressive way in Cuba. Indeed, Spain was acting in a repressive way. Concentration camps, mass arrests, killing people, trying to repress the insurgency. In addition, the rebellion in Cuba was said to be jeopardizing not only American lives and property on the island, but also the national security of the United States itself. And what Spain was doing to the poor Cubans was a violation of the sentiments of humanity. Well, these denunciations of Spanish cruelties, and there were plenty of Spanish cruelties, they increased in frequency as the U.S. decided it wanted to take over Spain's colonies. The U.S. Senate Foreign Relations Committee in 1898 reported, quote, "The duplicity, perfidy, and cruelty of the Spanish character. This is something the Spaniards have always been and still continue to be in Cuba." Secretary of War Russell Hagel talked about the inhuman cruelties and the absolute barbarity perpetrated by the Spaniards against the Cuban people. Well, a closer reading of history reveals that the U.S. leaders were more interested in national gain than in humanitarian rescue. That is, they were more interested in Cuba than in the Cubans. U.S. leaders had long coveted Cuba. Cuba, which was called the Pearl of the Antilles, you know, is one of the world's largest islands. It was endowed with fertile lands, natural resources, fine harbors. It was temptingly situated just 90 miles off the Florida coast at the gateway of the Gulf of Mexico. As early as 1823, Secretary of State John Quincy Adams noted, quote, "It is scarcely possible to resist the conviction that the annexation of Cuba to our federal republic will be indispensable to the continuance and integrity of the Union itself." At about that same time, an aging Thomas Jefferson wrote, quote, "The island, that is Cuba, will give itself to us when able to do so. Cuba's addition to our Confederacy is exactly what is wanted to round our power as a nation to the point of its utmost interest." In 1848, Secretary of State James Buchanan anticipated the following, quote, "Under our government, Cuba would speedily be Americanized as Louisiana has been." When Spain, by the way, refused to accept a U.S. offer for $100 million to buy the island, Buchanan was unrelenting. He went on and said, quote, "We can't do without Cuba, and above all, we must not suffer its transfer to Great Britain. We should acquire it by a coup d'etat at some propitious time." By the way, a lot of these leaders commented again and again about the fear that Great Britain might take Cuba from Spain, and we couldn't allow it. Up to that time, the U.S. leaders preferred to see Cuba remain as a Spanish possession. In 1825, Secretary of State Henry Clay wrote, "We could not consent to the occupation of these islands," that is, he was talking about Cuba and Puerto Rico, "by any other European power than Spain." When Mexico and Venezuela planned an expedition to Cuba to assist its independence struggle, the United States let it be known that it would block any such attempt to wrest the island from Spanish hands. So rather than supporting Cuban independence, U.S. leaders expressed a very strange partiality to Spanish rule until the very end of the century, that is, until they were ready to take over Cuba. Actually, that partiality wasn't so strange because Spain's weakness, as demonstrated by the rapid loss of all its great New World colonies, I mean, almost all of Latin America, they just lost it in a few years, led to a belief in Washington that Madrid would never be able to retain whole of its few remaining dependencies. Now, if Cuba were in the hands of a European power that was less feeble than Spain, this would make future U.S. domination much more problematic. Likewise, if Cuba was in the hands of a victorious and an independent Cuban liberation army or liberation force of ordinary Cubans themselves, this too could prove very troublesome to U.S. plans. The historian Luis Perez Jr. writes, quote, "Of all the possible alternatives to Spanish rule in Cuba, none aroused greater misgivings in Washington than Cuban independence." The specter of Cuban independence was the anathema of all American policymakers since Jefferson. It was worse even than seeing the British or French take it over. Now, Cuba not only exported a good deal of sugar to the States, but was becoming, despite Spanish restrictions, by the way, it was becoming an important market for U.S. manufactured goods. In addition, American business interests were developing substantial investments in Cuba, mostly in sugar and tobacco. The U.S. refused in 1825 and again in 1852 to go along with a British proposal guaranteeing Cuba to Spain. The U.S. were constantly afraid, supposedly afraid the British were going to take over Cuba. The British said, okay, we'll give guarantees. We won't touch it. You don't touch it. And we will guarantee that Spain controls Cuba. U.S. leaders refused to enter into that guarantee with the British. They were not ready to accept guarantees of a hands-off policy from London if it meant that the U.S. would have to commit itself to a similar restraint. In the latter half of the 19th century, American leaders made several offers to buy Cuba at bargain prices, and the Spaniards refused to sell. In 1875, it was clear in correspondence between Secretary of State Cushing and members of Congress that there was open contemplation of war with Spain over Cuba. Again, the U.S. interest was in Cuba, not for the independence of the Cubans. Successive American administrations from Grant to Cleveland to McKinley refused to aid or officially recognize the island's independence movement. In fact, the United States imposed an embargo on all private assistance to Cuban insurgents. The McKinley administration, like the ones before, maintained an energetic policy of interdicting private military expeditions to Cuba. They were called filibusters. The insurgent general, Antonio Maceo, fighting for his people in the jungles against the Spaniards, he observed that if the United States were really interested in helping the independence cause, it would support, even if tacitly, even if on the, you know, on the quiet, it would support a program of material aid, including arms and ammunition, for the insurrectos. 2 years later, the Cuban military leader, Maximo Gomez, made a similar observation. Quote, "The Americanos continually fill their newspapers with sympathy for our cause, but what do? They won't even give us a rifle." Gomez pointed out, however, that Spain was free to buy arms from the U.S. as much as they wanted. And they used those arms in Cuba. So much for U.S. policy of neutrality. Despite all these obstacles, by the way, the Cuban liberation forces were coming close to winning the war by 1898. Spain's army in Cuba, which numbered as high as 200,000, consisted mostly of youths between the ages of 15 and 18 years. These troops were sent out into the field immediately without any opportunity to get acclimated to tropical severities and build up any resistance. So they were poorly trained, underfed, improperly clad and sheltered, plagued by malnutrition, fatigue, heat prostration, malaria, yellow fever, dysentery, and a host of other diseases, and they died like flies. In 1897, some 35,000 Spanish soldiers perished from illnesses contracted in Cuba. Another 5,000 were killed in action. In all, between 1895 and 1898, about a 3.5-year period, Spain lost about 100,000 men. And that's only a nation of 18 million it was at that time. By January of 1898, the Spanish army wasn't even launching any winter offensives. They were just sitting in their garrisons and just barely holding on to a few cities and a few military posts. The Cuban insurrection was victorious. And by the way, this is what worried U.S. leaders. Many observers pointed out that Spain was exhausted, but in fact, Spain was more than exhausted. It was torn with grief and unrest over the losses sustained in Cuba. To make matters worse, by the way, another costly colonial rebellion had erupted in the Philippines, and that too was forcing Madrid to send additional thousands away and costing vast casualties. Spanish war widows and orphans were dying slowly of starvation, reported the New York Times. Desertions increased. Thousands of Spaniards evaded conscription by going into hiding or emigrating. Army units mutinied outright, Some of them refused to board ships that were headed for Cuba or the Philippines. Food riots and anti-war protests erupted with increasing frequency. And the Republican political organizations, Republican with a small r, that is, those who were opposed to the monarchy, the Republican political organizations were growing in strength. The American minister in Madrid, about that time, pointed out that Spain was on the verge of collapse, maybe even revolution. He said, bread is rising in price, work is scarce, and there is certainly much popular discontent. The common people are tired of the Cuban and Philippine wars. And Madrid newspapers themselves were announcing that Spain had lost Cuba and should negotiate the island's independence. So while the American public was still being fed images of a ruthless, brutal, powerful Spain brutalizing this defenseless little Cuba, U.S. officials knew better. The U.S. leaders, including many in McKinley's own cabinet, including his own Secretary of State and Assistant Secretary of State, and including McKinley himself, were of the opinion that Spain was exhausted financially and physically, that the Cuban rebels were stronger, and that it was a matter of time before the insurgents took over the whole island. In the areas that the insurgents controlled, they had their own schools, their hospitals, they were running agricultural organizations, they were collecting taxes, they were the effective government. Now, Cuba was only part of the story behind the war that ensued. U.S. political and economic leaders were casting hungry glances at more distant places. The president of the National Association of Manufacturers announced, quote, many of our manufacturers have outgrown or are outgrowing their home markets, and the expansion of our foreign trade is their only promise of relief. By 1894, the United States ranked first in the world in the value of its manufacturing. With this growing productivity, it needed new markets. It needed new areas of investment. Bankers, too, were beginning to consider overseas investment as a means of putting their idle capital to work, either through direct loans to foreigners or by financing American companies abroad. So it wasn't just some national restlessness, or America was coming of age, or America was getting its identity, or America got all jingo and egoistic, or whatever else that led to the war. There were no mass demonstrations in America for empire as such, but there was a real pressure for commercial and financial expansion abroad. And that pressure didn't come from the common people. Increasingly, business people came to believe that the way to recovery from the stagnation left by the Depression of 1893 might best be generated by expanding into other countries. American industry needed Asia's vast markets, its cheap labor, its vital resources, and access to that could best be secured by a chain of annexations across the Pacific, including Hawaii, Guam, and the Philippines. And Guam and the Philippines were both owned by Spain. Iron interests, steel, oil, textile, cotton, flour interests, along with a lot of exporting houses and railroad investors seeking concessions in China, they all pressured Washington to formulate a policy to move into the Far East to counter the German and Russian presence there. Senator Albert Beveridge said it very well. Our largest trade henceforth must be with Asia. By the way, he was wrong. The largest trade ended up being with Latin America and Europe. But they thought, they seriously thought it would have to be Asia. And that determined their policy. And to quote Beveridge, the Philippines give us a base at the door of all the East. The power that rules the Pacific is the power that rules the world. And with the Philippines, that power is and will forever be the American Republic. Well, I'd point out that political leaders like Presidents Cleveland and President McKinley and other business leaders preferred not to go to war if they could get what they wanted by other means. That's true today, too. So when they say we're not for war, it's true. If they could get the thing without war, they much prefer it that way. War was to be considered only as a last resort, but it was never entirely ruled out. President Grover Cleveland, quote, "The United States is not a nation to which peace is a necessity." Sounds like George Bush, except he wouldn't say it, he just does it. Now, as the conflict with Spain drew close, there were elements in the business community that opposed war. There were some Wall Street brokers who feared that a war would upset an already shaky stock market. There was the Beet Sugar Trust that didn't want Cuban sugar coming in. There were others, too. But by 1897, the financial and manufacturing giants, the business people, who count the most at the crucial junctures were filled with war talks, and I'm talking about the Rockefeller and Morgan Associates, including William Rockefeller and J.P. Morgan himself. I'm talking about John Jacob Astor. I'm talking about Auguste Belmont and Russell Sage and others of the Eastern moneyed establishment. They began to pressure the White House to intervene. But when they thought about a war with Spain, it was more with the Philippines in mind than with Cuba. And it was no accident then that the first battle of the Spanish-American War was fought not in Cuba, but thousands of miles away in the Philippines in Manila Bay. Manila also was a big attraction to the U.S. Navy, by the way, because they could have their fueling bases and their bases of operation, and that was important for them. Now, the usual scenario that we get, and that we got in school, and everybody believes, right, left, or center, everybody in America believes that the Spanish-American War went like this. The yellow press, the jingoist imperialist press, led by William Randolph Hearst, created a popular hysteria, and this hysteria pushed Congress and a reluctant President McKinley into the war. But the press cannot really create a policy. The press doesn't even create public opinion for the war. It creates opinion visibility. It creates a pressure. But by the way, there were many newspapers that were against that war. The people of the country, of the U.S. themselves, were deeply divided. There were small farmers and populace who were not hungry for war. They were just hungry. There were labor leaders and unions who called for independence for the Cuban people, but not for war. Even a conservative labor leader like Samuel Gompers joined the anti-imperialists and was against the war. The opinion in the black community was instructive. In an open letter to President McKinley, the Colored National League made this statement. They noted that when McKinley appeared in the South, he appeared before segregated audiences in Alabama. And they said to him, quote, "We notice how you preach patience, industry, moderation to your long-suffering black fellow citizens and patriotism, jingoism, and imperialism to your white ones." They observed that it's odd that the U.S. government says there is no federal jurisdiction when it comes to trying to stop the murders and atrocities that were going on in South Carolina, Alabama, Georgia, Illinois, Kansas, and a number of other states. The federal government had no jurisdiction. That was a matter for the states. Yet how impressively eager the federal government was to extend protection to American lives all across the globe, that the federal government had jurisdiction in Cuba and would speak out against the crimes in Cuba, but wouldn't speak out against the crimes in Georgia. And so the black community noticed this. And there were other black newspapers that said, "Let Uncle Sam keep hands off other countries till he has learned to govern his own. Human life at home should be protected before reaching out to protect others." A Richmond black newspaper said, "People denied the right to vote should be excused from the duty to fight for their country." The Washington Bee in Washington, D.C. said, "The Negro needs freedom as much as the Cubans." Aside from race, there was some of the black press that even questioned the necessity and legitimacy of the war on its own grounds. They thought it was oddly inconsistent that the U.S. was apparently concerned about the Cubans and yet doing nothing for the Cuban independence fighters themselves. They said things like, why did not the McKinley administration recognize the Cuban revolutionary government, sell them supplies and munitions, and let them alone to win their own independence, instead of having to enter directly into the war? On the eve of the war, by the way, Spain acceded to all U.S. demands on Cuba. Spain agreed to pay reparations to the Cubans. They agreed to abolish the detention camps. They agreed to grant total autonomy and move toward independence. They declared a ceasefire and armistice, and they declared a joint international mediation on the battleship Maine. Now, this created a problem, because how could we grab Puerto Rico, Guam, the Philippines, and Cuba if Spain denied us the cause for war by being so agreeable? So McKinley took the concessions, ignored them, and went to war anyway. And there were some newspapers in America, including those that had supported intervention, that began to ask, what was the U.S. going to war for? If it was to free the Cubans from Spanish tyranny, why were we invading the Philippines and engaging in a bloody, brutal 2-year war against Aguinaldo and the Philippine guerrillas? Why were we imitating what the Spaniards had done in Cuba in the Philippines, including the concentration camps and the mass executions? If we were going to war to free Cuba, which is what we had heard, why did we enter Cuba and deny recognition to the Cuban Liberation Forces and the Cuban government that existed there? Why were we more friendly with the rich Cubans and the rich Spaniards in the cities and treated the Cuban insurrectos as peons? Well, partly it was because they were peons. They were poor, mestizos, and blacks. They represented not just a struggle for independence, but a struggle for revolution. And this was anathema to McKinley and the class he represented. McKinley went to Cuba to prevent a successful Cuban Revolutionary War, a war for independence, not to support the war as the American public had been led to believe. And so it was with these imperialists. They used anti-imperialist sentiment, the widespread support among the American public for Cuban independence and the end of Spanish imperialism, they used that anti-imperialist feeling to advance the cause of American imperialism, playing on that sentiment to get us into a war that didn't liberate anyone, that imprisoned the Filipinos, that put the Cubans under U.S. political and economic suzerainty. Cuban was given a formal independence by 1902. So it was an empire with colonies in the Philippines, and it was an empire without colonies. That is, you didn't have to own Cuba, you just controlled all its industry, its imports, its exports, its land, and its farms, and its economy. And so today, still, that same kind of thing goes on. They fabricate excuses to get into this or that country and make the world safe for hypocrisy and for rich investors.
That was a rebroadcast of Dr. Michael Parenti's lecture on the Spanish-American War and the Rise of U.S. Imperialism. Time to follow the March 2016 visit to Cuba by President Obama. A review of part of a history that deeply shaped Cuba's destiny and is barely remembered here in the U.S. Michael Parenti is among our leading progressive political analysts. He received his PhD in political science from Yale in 1962. Parenti lost his access to tenure when he was arrested and seriously beaten in a protest against the war on Vietnam. Parenti is also a prolific author. Among his most recent books are Profit Pathology and Other Indecencies in 2015, The Face of Imperialism, and the ninth edition of his most popular book, Democracy for the Few, in 2011, and God and His Demons in 2010. You can hear this program again for free on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. Look at the newest programs or the podcast page. While you're there, you can subscribe to weekly free podcasts. Downloads are free, and we appreciate any size donation to keep TUC Radio on the air. My name is Maria Gelardin. Thank you for listening.